This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author Blanche Wiesen-Cook joins us to talk about the third and final installment in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt.
A great woman whose core issues on desegregation, world peace, and economic justice are still with us.
We're joined by Daryl Lamont Jenkins of One People's Project. They're in the business of outing far right-wingers.
Unfortunately, these ideas are spreading, and there are a lot of people and organizations to out.
We also acknowledge and say thanks to our many affiliates across the country.
Yeah, we're up to about 100, aren't we?
Yes. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Eleanor Roosevelt was a modest, self-deprecating, but forceful and effective advocate for human rights. She was married to the four-term Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was in office throughout the Great Depression and World War II. During this time, Eleanor Roosevelt grew into her own as an influential world figure. She helped in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the founding of the United Nations. She fought for racial equality, economic security, health care for all, and world peace. We speak today with Blanche Wiesen-Cook, who is a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Professor Cook has just published the third volume of her monumental biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, titled Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. She has worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights and Michael Ratner in getting public access to government documents through the Freedom of Information Act requests. Cook has also contributed to the book Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA.
Blanche Wiesen-Cook, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much, Heidi and Michael. This is really wonderful to be with you.
It's good to have you back on WBAI. You used to have your own program. You're ready to do this one.
In the 1970s, activists and agitators.
Needed more than ever.
Yes, we need it more than ever. And what I've been saying about my book, Eleanor Roosevelt, We Need to March Again, My Darling, shoulder to shoulder, trooping for democracy with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Blanche, who was Eleanor Roosevelt, and why were you drawn to her?
Oh, what a wonderful question. Well, who she was always an activist, always changing, always wanting to make things better for people in want and need and trouble. And how she got to be that way is that she was, you know, she had a miserable, sad, tragic childhood. Her father was an alcoholic who she loved, and he died at the age of 34. And that always gives me pause. I mean, how much do you have to drink?
You gotta pickle yourself at that young age.
To die at the age of 34. Her mother died when Eleanor Roosevelt was 8. Her father died when she was 10. And, you know, you can imagine, we know alcoholism, the family disease. You can imagine what life was like between her parents. Her mother essentially turned her face to the wall and perished. And so then Eleanor Roosevelt lived with her grandmother, who essentially saved her life, but was not very happy. She had aunts and uncles who were also, you know, involved with drugs and alcohol. And then she had the great good fortune to go off to school in England at Allenswood School, where she met the great Marie Souvestre, who changed her life. And Eleanor Roosevelt became a star, became a leader. She had already been fluent in French, so she was very lucky because classes were given in French. And so Eleanor Roosevelt, and she said, she wrote at the age of 76 that the happiest day of her life was the day she made the first team at field hockey. That is so great because it tells you everything you need to know. She loved sports. She was competitive. She wanted to win. And she wanted to make things better for all people. She had the great good fortune in some ways to marry her fifth cousin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And although they had a hard marriage, a difficult marriage, we know a lot about men with power. And the way they have to have, it seems, a lot of women in their lives. And so they had this difficult relationship, but a splendid partnership.
Did their political and personal interests diverge and change in the course of their relationship?
Eleanor Roosevelt always believed that Franklin, too, shared her vision to make things better for all people. But she called him a juggler. She was the first one to call him a juggler. And he had to deal with a Dixiecrat, what we now call a Dixiecrat Congress, dominated by isolationists and Southern bigots. And Eleanor Roosevelt's vision for democracy and for human rights and peace was, how can we go into World War II and fight fascism segregated and racist? And so that became an issue she really promoted, and she promoted it from the 1930s on, and we should talk about that in a minute. But FDR needed to get defense spending, needed to get military spending, and he needed to cajole and manage his hideous isolationist Republicans and Dixiecrat Democrat run Congress.
Blanche, what were her positions on economic security for all, racial equality, and international peace?
Okay, that they were connected is really the brilliant thing that we need to keep in mind. Eleanor Roosevelt said repeatedly, we won't have peace until we have economic security for all, jobs for all, until everybody is educated and trained to do good work. And I just want to say, long before Bernie, Eleanor Roosevelt said, why don't we have free college education for everybody? It should be free and available. She also said, this is 1943, she gave that speech. She also said in 1934, the first time this is in volume two, but I repeat it in volume three because it becomes the theme of her life. The first time the educators of America condemn school segregation, and they condemn it in much the language of Brown versus the Board of Education. It destroys racial harmony. It destroys all hope for community. Black children are encouraged to feel inferior. White children are encouraged to feel superior. And it destroys all hope of community, which is clearly the point. And Eleanor Roosevelt strides upon the stage and says, how stupid we are not to give excellent public education to everybody so that every child can achieve the utmost that child is capable of. And at the end of this great speech, she says, we will all go ahead together, or we will all go down together. And that vision is really her vision throughout her life, for the rest of her life. We won't have peace until we have economic security. And the end of greed, she talks about how we must stop this infatuation and romance with greed and things and money. We have to see what we can do to build democracy, community, and live together in peace and justice. So that's her vision, and it's all connected, and she's the one who connects it. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the end of her life really is her final legacy, but she's building towards that from the 1920s on, when she says we have to go door to door, block by block, and build movements. We have to be trooping for democracy. And of course, that's what we have to do now. We have to build movements and troop for democracy.
And we want to talk a bit more about that, but you mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What role did Eleanor play in the founding of the United Nations?
Well, FDR, really beginning in the 1940s, says what we need is a United Nations to continue what the League of Nations started, but the U.S. failed to join. And so there it is, the idea for United Nations. And Harry Truman sends Eleanor Roosevelt to Paris in 19. FDR dies in April 1945, and Eleanor Roosevelt says the story is over. But a whole new story begins with Eleanor Roosevelt going off to be a U.S. representative at the United Nations. And there she is, a brilliant diplomat. And she speaks with everybody. She speaks many languages, although she is a really vigorous anti-communist, you know, vigorous. She doesn't trust the Soviets at all, but she insists on speaking with them, meeting with them, dining with them. She invites them to her home for lunch, for breakfast, for dinner. And, you know, she is just part of a diplomatic effort to get the Universal Declaration of Human Rights passed so that the Soviets don't veto it. They don't vote no. They abstain on some issues. There are many issues in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights where there is unanimity. And then there's a moment when Harry Truman says, do not vote for the economic and social rights that are Soviet inspired in the Universal Declaration. She says, no, that's wrong. You can't talk human rights to people who are hungry. And if you want me to do that, I will resign. And he doesn't want her to resign. And he says, no, follow your convictions. And that's the origins of the compromise, which she agrees to have two covenants. And that's a great tragedy. We still haven't even had a conversation about the economic and social rights.
Let's talk about the two separate covenants, the economic and social rights, and then the political rights. They finally, I think, the United States agreed to the economic. They haven't agreed to the economic. They agreed to the political rights. Tell that story and then talk about the two different covenants and why they're important.
Well, they're really important because, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a statement like the Magna Carta. It's a vision for the future. It's a vision. It's what we all aspire to. Now, of the over 200 nations at the United Nations, most, the vast majority, have ratified both covenants. And it's the covenants that bring it into force, okay? So the nations are responsible for what happens in their nations according to these covenants. The U.S. finally, and people don't know this because George Herbert Walker Bush, who is the man who ratifies, who gets the civil and political covenant ratified after the Soviet Union collapses, he decides it's time to support the civil and political rights. And if somebody does an Oedipal biography of the Bushes, you know, it's really his son, who I call George War Bush, W. Bush. Everything his daddy did, he does the opposite. His daddy says, no, we won't go to war in Iraq. George W. Bush does. His daddy says, we will stand for civil and political rights. And George W. Bush says, no, we won't. We'll torture. And it's really an extraordinary reality. The Republicans have not wanted to claim victory here. And so, you know, people don't know that we have. And it took that long. I mean, it didn't come up again. From 19, it was finally passed. The covenants were finally passed 50 years ago in 1966, actually in December 1966. So this is the 50th anniversary of the covenants. And then they didn't come up again until Jimmy Carter. But then Jimmy Carter didn't really push to have the Senate ratify it. George Herbert Walker Bush did.
What about the economic and social rights?
Okay.
What are those, and why are they important, and why does the United States not deal with it?
Well, let me just say the economic and social rights, housing for all, health care for all, and, you know, health care for all is so immediate for everybody, jobs for all, education for all, the economic and social rights that we know of. All the things that Eleanor Roosevelt fought for her entire life. And the good news is there's a wonderful group, NESRI.org, NESRI.org, that exists to keep, to really bring back the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Covenant, and the Economic and Social Rights into the U.S. conversation. We've never even had a debate about it. I, of course, was hoping that Hillary Clinton would be president and she would bring it up, because she has been inspired by Eleanor Roosevelt, and now we're in this unknown abyss. I have no idea where we're going, but we need, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, to troop for democracy and human rights, go door to door and build movements. And NESRI is part of that, and there are movements.
Yeah, she's comrade and a friend of ours, and do a
Kathy
shout out
Albisa.
To Kathy
yes,
and
great.
Her organization.
Could we talk a bit about her relationship with Paul Robeson?
Yeah, because it's complicated, because Paul Robeson personally understood finally that the Soviet Union was no paradise, that politically there was a lot of repression there. When he went over there to concertize, they had to run the water and play the radio when he talked to friends of his in his hotel room. So he knew the score, but he personally, and Pete Seeger took the same position, he personally didn't want to publicly criticize the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, Eleanor Roosevelt defended his right to perform in the United States. When he was attacked at the famous Peekskill concert, she came to his defense. So they had a complicated relationship. And I wanted to ask you about that, and then ask you about another famous entertainer, Harry Belafonte. Of course, was a much younger man when Eleanor knew him, and ask you about that, too.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt really was very angry at Paul Robeson. And then she paused to consider, what is it that is going on in the United States so that someone as gifted and talented and, you know, brilliant as Paul Robeson would go to the Soviet Union and think that was a better place to live and that was where he wanted to bring his children up? What is wrong with the United States that someone as loved as Paul Robeson would go with his family to bring his children up in the Soviet Union? And she paused to consider it, and, you know, then we have to integrate. We have to have respect for everybody. And there's a bit of tension between them when he wants to bring a Soviet-initiated referendum to the United Nations. We charge genocide.
Yes.
And Eleanor Roosevelt will not accept the Soviet-inspired we charge genocide. We haven't done genocide to black people, but we have to take responsibility for what we have done to black people, which is this hideous discrimination and segregation and so on. And Eleanor Roosevelt says, we cannot lead the free world while we have segregation. She's very clear about that. And then when Paul Robeson is attacked, Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, does come to his defense. Harry Belafonte is a closer friend. She hears Harry Belafonte. She first hears him when he is on tour in, you know, old Europe, as it were. And they become friends. She's a great fan. And they meet in Harry Belafonte's home, and Harry Belafonte's little boy, she's holding the baby on her lap, and the baby pees on her lap, and she says, well, thank you for your opinion, little man. And of course, that endears her to the Belafontes. But the bottom line is, we are so racist, even in New York. New York is totally segregated. And when Harry Belafonte and his wife and child try to get an apartment in New York City, you know, in Manhattan, they can't get an apartment. And they know that there are apartments available because their white friends have just gotten some apartments. So Eleanor Roosevelt invites the Belafontes to live with her. She can't imagine anybody she'd be happier to live with than the Belafontes and their beautiful child. And she writes about it, but Harry Belafonte and his wife, along with Lena Horne and other people, buy a great building instead. And so finally, the famous Riverside Drive, West End Avenue area is slightly integrated with their famous building.
On a personal note, Blanche, what drew you to spend nearly three decades researching this woman?
Well, at first I thought I could finish this book in 2 years. I had just done my Eisenhower book, and I must say, when I see Michael Smith, I think of Michael Ratner, Mike Ratner and the Freedom of Information Act. We were on tour, and we were on BAI a lot of times talking about the Freedom of Information Act, because everything I wanted to know was secret and classified. Everything about Guatemala, everything about the overthrow of Dr. Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. So I always say never go anywhere without your gang. And I went back to the city from Abilene, Kansas, and we created the Fund for Open Information and Accountability, and sued to get documents released, including Eleanor Roosevelt's huge FBI file.
I mean, 4,000 pages.
Yes, 4,000 pages. I mean, and here we have, you know, John Edgar Comey, I mean, James Comey, doing what J. Edgar Hoover did to Eleanor Roosevelt, really tried to sabotage her. And anyway, it's an incredible story. But the bottom line is, Kate Stimson kept sending me books to review when I was lonely and alone in Abilene, a dry town. You can't even get wine with dinner. And one of the books she sent me was this book by Doris Faber on Hick, Lorena Hickok. And that was eye-opening, although the book denied these letters could possibly mean what they seemed to mean. And so I wrote a vigorous review saying, Pache, Sigmund Freud, a cigar may not always be a cigar, but the northeast corner of your mouth against my lips is always the northeast corner. And I had dinner with my pal Joe Lash, who was Eleanor Roosevelt's, you know, favorite son and adopted son and favorite biographer. And he doesn't have a word about Hick. So to make a very long story short, we had dinner and he persuaded me to consider writing about Eleanor Roosevelt. He took me to Hyde Park, to the Roosevelt Library, and I saw I had a story. And I thought I could do that story. This was 1982. My Eisenhower book had just come out. I thought I could do that by her centennial in 1984. But as Joe Lash said, Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite. And, you know, I kept finding more and more information. As a result of my Eisenhower book, I served on the State Department Historical Advisory Committee for about 8 years. And my boss kept sending me, you know, boxes of material before each meeting. And I said to him, Bill Slaney, I said, look at all the stuff you send me. What would Eleanor Roosevelt's file look like from 1946 to 1953 when Eisenhower got rid of her? And he said, let's go look for it. And we found 198 boxes, which, because at the time I had top security clearance, we just declassified the whole thing. As Joe Lash said, Eleanor Roosevelt's infinite. There's more work for a lot of other people to do. I'm done.
What surprised you, if anything, during all of your research? Does anything stand out?
I think the most surprising thing for me was how Eleanor Roosevelt kept growing and changing. She just never stopped learning and growing and building movements. And everywhere she went, she had only two questions. Tell me, what do you want? What do you need? And that capacity for empathy and concern was amazing. And then her ability to forgive a lot of things.
You know, I've been just entranced by your book. It's a 600-page book, and I've read half of it so far. And one of the things that interested me so much was a comment that our mutual friend Frances Golden made to me a couple years ago. She said, Eleanor Roosevelt was a socialist. And I didn't know that much about Eleanor Roosevelt. I admired her, but I didn't know that much about her. And I'm beginning to think that Frances Golden was right in that comment. I wanted to know your opinion on that.
Frances Golden, in my opinion, is always right. But the bottom line is she was a democratic socialist. What she's asking for is housing for all, health care for all. It was supposed to be in the 1935 Social Security Act, and the AMA lobbied it to death. So single payer, what we now call single payer, Esther Lape, L-A-P-E, I always spell it because I want someone to write a biography of this great woman who had a vision. She was Eleanor Roosevelt's mentor, and she and Elizabeth Reed, her partner, you know, they tutored Eleanor Roosevelt. They brought her to the left. Socialism, they don't use the word, but it is democratic socialism. This is what has to happen if there is going to be stability, security, peace in the world, and it has to happen worldwide. When you think of how slowly we've moved on these issues, and even Social Security, which is now under threat, but in 1935 it was segregated. that, I mean, what the things that black people tended to do, including teachers, were not covered. Teachers, domestic workers, farm workers were not covered by Social Security. So we had, you know, I mean, revolution is a process and not an event. But there's no question that socialism was behind the vision.
Blanche, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. Heidi and I wanted to ask you what your final thoughts are about Eleanor and why you think she's relevant to these particular hard times that we're looking at.
Well, people have asked me, what would Eleanor say now? And I keep running around in my mind an editorial. This is what Eleanor Roosevelt might say to the incoming president. Listen, little man, you need to learn some history. There really is a difference between democracy and authoritarianism. And I have never approved of Gestapo tactics. And then we need to be a leader in the world. You want to make America great again. Well, you can't make America great with the Ku Klux Klan, and you can't make America great by insulting women and people of color and struggle and minorities. And we have a great freedom of worship. And so here for you to read is my husband's legacy, The Four Freedoms. Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from fear. And we need some freedom from fear right now, because you are very scary. Well, we have a man who looks like Mussolini and sounds like Hitler. So, who is going? And so we will troop for democracy, shoulder to shoulder.
Blanche, to whom did you dedicate the book?
Well, actually, I dedicate it to the memory of some great radical attorneys and lovers, people I loved, including Mike Ratner and Rhonda Copeland, who passed recently. But I dedicated the book to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls.
Blanche, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We recommend your book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. We recommend it with great enthusiasm. We sure appreciate your coming on the show.
And I appreciate your show so much. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
Thank
you. This is really great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This past summer, an ambitious volunteer-run organization has taken on clandestine Ku Klux Klan rallies, wives of prominent neo-Nazis running for judgeships, and even rock bands with neo-Nazi connections. The One People's Project has been called, quote, a scrappier version of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Its timely mission is to research and report on right, far-right, and racist individuals and organizations in an effort to eradicate hate. Its members do not shy away from outing individuals associated with white supremacist groups, especially if that person holds a position of responsibility or prominence in a community. And they are the first to admit that they are not polite in their pursuit. The project's website features a, quote, rogues gallery, an alphabetical list with photos of persons they claim to know to be white nationalists. We're joined today by Daryl Lamont Jenkins, founder and active member of One People's Project. Daryl, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Daryl, you founded the One People's Project in 2000, and in a very few short years, you're already going to be on Arts and Entertainment in a program that spawned a bit of controversy. What is it called, and what is the controversy about?
Well, the program is called Generation KKK, and I think because of the title alone, folks are concerned that this is a show that's going to normalize the Klan. and it's definitely not that. What it is about, myself and two other activists, Brian Widener and Arnold Michaelis, who used to be in white supremacist groups, are coming together to basically try to encourage family members who are involved in the Klan to try to get them out. And we're brought on by those family members who are trying to find a way out of the Klan, find a way away from that element. So for those who are concerned, it is definitely not something that's there to glorify the Klan. I would not be involved with anything of the sort. And I need to make that clear.
Now, doesn't it demystify the Klan in a way?
Demystify, insofar that it demystifies, that also diminishes them. Because they want to be mystified. They want to have that aura of, I guess, mystique, I guess. I guess that's the best way to put it. And we take that away from them. We show them for who they are. And who they are people who have a whole lot of problems that even go beyond their bigotry. And they are definitely not someone, not a group of people who we would look towards for inspiration.
So, narrow-minded, what are some of the other issues?
Narrow-minded, you have a lot of family issues going on. Some will be addressed on the show, some will not. That's just the way it goes. But I would just say that a lot of times you would just see folks that are just looking for an outlet. And unfortunately, these folks found an outlet in the Klan. Some folks found an outlet in the Klan. Others are coming from a new generation. You're talking about a lot of kids here that are going to be on the show. And they're not their fathers or their mothers. They are looking at a different future that doesn't involve the Klan and cannot involve the Klan. They have black friends. They have black relatives.
And yet they're still white supremacists.
They're not white supremacists. Oh. The kids and maybe even some of the adults around them are not white supremacists, but they have this pressure from the family members that are. And that's where the problem comes in. And that's where we come in to try to pull them away from that element, including Klan members themselves. We try. And it just remains to be seen how it works out for some folks. You have to see the show. But please, folks, watch the show before you pass judgment.
Daryl, you follow these things closely. Would you say that the Klan, particularly with the current atmosphere around Trump, that the Klan is growing? Or would you say because they're so exotic, you know, with Grand Clapton and the white costumes they wear and so on? My guess would be that other extremist hate groups are have a wind in their sails more than the Klan. But I don't know. I mean, what's your opinion?
You're probably right on that one. I think that the Klan does have a history that scares folks, and just the idea of the Klan will scare people away. But they do have a little bit of momentum because of what has happened in recent months, and especially with the election. They do see that momentum. Having said that, when you want to look at the people who are going to be the biggest problem, they're not going to call themselves the Klan. They're going to call themselves names like the Council of Conservative Citizens, the National Policy Institute. They'll have websites that are called American Renaissance. They'll hold conferences as opposed to rallies. And they will network, most importantly, they will network within the Beltway of D.C. A lot of them do come out of the D.C. Beltway. So it's really important to remember that while the Klan is a big issue and a big threat, the people who are probably even bigger are the ones that are influencing those who are going to write the laws. Some of them are even writing the laws.
Let's talk about how the One People's Project works. Can you describe some of your tactics? We know you have on your website a list of individuals you believe are racist.
Correct.
But what do you do? Do you go to some of these conferences? How do you identify such individuals?
Well, we approach it just like any news outlet would. We are reporters. We're reporters first. We're not really activists first. We're reporters first. So that means we have to go and get the facts. The only way you're going to be able to get the facts is if you're there to get the facts. So we do the research that we need to on certain individuals. We go to the conferences and the rallies, as you say. Sometimes we're there by ourselves. And we get the information that we can give to people and start encouraging them to be proactive.
And you take photos of individuals?
And we take photos of individuals, video of individuals. Some of them you'll find on YouTube, me taunting them in many cases.
And do you confront them and say, for example, you know, we know you're part of a hate group or neo-Nazi?
Yes. That's where I was getting at when I was saying some of them are taunting, because I have a habit of getting a little upset whenever these individuals and these groups are allowed to spew their nonsense unopposed. Sometimes it's ridicule. Sometimes I'm just straight up cussing them out. Sometimes it's cordial.
Your tactics are sort of in your face, would we say.
Exactly, exactly.
And what kind of responses have you gotten? Have you been threatened? Are you ever fearful?
Oh, they've written songs about me, and they've threatened me. We've been attacked in the streets. We fought back. I mean, I come from the anti-fascist scene. We are used to getting into physical confrontations with this crowd. I've been doing it for 30 years, so that's the way it goes. But as I get older, I'm 48 years old, you can't get into too many of them. So, but yes, I've had my parents' home threatened. It's funny because for the past 16 years, my friend pointed it out, that for the past 16 years, I've been known more on the right than I have been on the left. And I think that's pretty beneficial. But by the same token, I do miss the support base that I would need from the left that I don't get because they don't know who I am or know who One People's Project is.
Let's talk more about Inside the Beltway, which is so worrisome to all of us. Mm-hmm. Richard Spencer. Is his outfit called the National Policy Institute?
Yes.
And you know about him. Share that with us. What's the danger there?
Well, One People's Project was one of the first organizations to really call out Richard Spencer. And we have been going to his conferences since about 2010. That's when he had his first conference, when it was nothing but 50 old white men wondering why they didn't have enough women there. And now it's morphed into this thing where you see a whole lot of young folks, about 300, at their conference this past month. Spencer has been around for a while, however. He worked for Pat Buchanan. He was an editor of his magazine. Then he moved on to another blog called Taki Mag, which is another, they call it paleoconservative, we call it suit and tie Nazis. Eventually, he came up with his own blog that was called Alternative Right. That's where that alt-right term comes from. He used it in one of his blog that he founded with someone else by the name of Colin Liddell. To give you an idea of how bad Alternative Right was, and this came out in 2010, they once published an article calling for black genocide. Calling for black genocide. That was the basis of the article. It was written by Colin Liddell. And they got a lot of flack for it, so they took it down, but it was still there. I confronted him about that during the RNC. He was in public square wearing a sign that says, "Want to talk to a racist?" So I talked to him, and I asked him about that. So he goes, "It's a joke." I said, "It wasn't funny." But Spencer has been around for a number of years, and I'll just tell you flat out, the only real job that he has ever had was conservative propagandist. He's a spoiled little rich kid with no other real world experience other than being a conservative propagandist.
What kind of connections does this fella and his outfit have with the Trump people?
Well, it's weird because while I hesitate to say that he has a direct connection to Trump because I can't really point to anything that says that, one of the interesting things is this. They regularly hold conferences at the same time the Conservative Political Action Conference takes place, CPAC. We have some video on YouTube right now of one of those conferences being letting out. It was at the National Press Club back in February 2015. And you see a bunch of people coming out. We were just basically trying to get names and faces, basically faces. And you see a discussion going back and forth between one of the attendees and a black woman who, for some strange reason, was attending the conference. And you hear the guy try to encourage her to start supporting Donald Trump. Now, this was in February 2015. Donald Trump did not announce until June. We got to ask, what kind of influence do they have, if not on Trump per se, about the people that are around Trump? And I think really, when it comes right down to it, they are going to be an even bigger threat than Trump himself.
Let's talk a little more about the kinds of people who go to some of these conferences. You mentioned that a lot of young people are starting to get involved. Are they recruited? How did they start to become a part of these movements?
Well, we only started seeing that over the past year. For a long time, Spencer and company, and for that matter, Jared Taylor, can only muster up 50 to 100 people. By the way, Jared Taylor is the publisher of the aforementioned American Renaissance. They will hold these conferences, and it will basically be the same old white men. And all of a sudden, when you start seeing Spencer going out to CPAC and trying to hold these conferences, then you start seeing it grow. One of the other areas that Spencer has recruited was via the internet, via those trolls out there that hassle everybody. More to the point, he's been gaining a lot of momentum courtesy of those so-called men's rights activists that glorify and call for the legalization of rape and believe in a really rigid patriarchy. Folks like, and I'm going to use their names, like Matt Forney, a gentleman by the name of Roosh. People know these names, and they have no love for women, literally. And these are the people that come along with Spencer and boost up his numbers. So, and they also get themselves involved in the neo-fascist slash white supremacist scene in the process.
Are a lot of the activities promoting hate groups, including those that hate women and I guess that white men perceive as a threat, are happening on the so-called deep web where addresses are untraceable and you have to know where they are to find them?
Now, truth be told, you just see it on Reddit all the time and you will see it just on Facebook. A lot of them are gamers. We talk often these days about a gentleman by the name of Milo Yiannopoulos, and he comes out of all of that too. So
who is he?
Milo Yiannopoulos is an editor at Breitbart.com. He is a consummate troll, a white supremacist troll. He boasts about being gay and Jewish and sleeping with black men, but when you hear him talk, that doesn't mean a darn thing. And he has a very hostile attitude towards decent people. Let's just run it down like that. So he's on a college campus tour where he's just basically going there to insult the student body. Folks have been telling their respective universities not to host this guy because all he is about hate mongering. And the University of Milwaukee, I believe it was, just had him on, and he went in on a transgender student, and everybody got upset about that. He just singled out a student at that school, and basically the response to that was to go after the students going after the university, saying, "We told you this was going to happen."
Yeah, University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
Yes, University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
I went to summer school there one time. We're speaking with Daryl Lamont Jenkins from One People's Project. Daryl, let me request that our listeners get a pencil. And how can people get in touch with One People's Project?
One People's Project's web address is www.onepeoplesproject.com. We also have another website, which is basically our newsline. It's called IDAVOX, IDAVOX.com. You can get information from both those sites. As mentioned, there is a Rogues Gallery section on the One People's Project website that'll give you an idea of the kinds of people that we have been more or less fighting over the past 16 years. We're getting newer and more updated entries as we go along. We have to update quite a few of them these days, but those are the places to reach us.
Thank you. What are you working on as we sit here today? What kind of stuff are you doing now?
Well, right now I'm busy promoting the new A&E TV show, Generation KKK. I think it's going to be a rather eye-opening experience for all of us. I think it's still going to be eye-opening for me even when it airs. And on top of that, I'm also trying to go around the country, trying to speak to various groups. So if anybody wants to host One People's Project, myself, or even, I should point this out, or even the people that are on Generation KKK with me, Brian Wyden and Arno Michaelis, at their on their campuses or their events, please let us know.
I have to go back to this subject because as we're as we're talking to you, I've been doing a little online searching, and Breitbart News has an article titled "Controversial Men's Rights Group Promoting Legalized Rape Cancels Meetups in Texas," and I just want to read this. A controversial men's rights group headed up by a self-proclaimed pickup artist and legalized rape blogger planned meetups worldwide for like-minded members but canceled them after criticism. And there's a group called, an online group called Return of Kings.
That's his.
Aha. They planned an international meetup day for 165 meetings in 43 countries. They advocate men's dominance over women. I had no idea about this. Did you, Michael?
No.
Give you an idea of how bad that gets. When you talk about the dark web, no, it's on Fox News.
Right.
Because there's a guy by the name of Gavin McInnes, the founder of Vice Magazine. He's no longer with Vice Magazine. That's a part of that crowd. That's a part of the crowd that's really going out and promoting this. And he shows up on Fox News on a regular basis, sometimes on a late night program that they have there. And he's here in New York.
And he talks about promoting rape?
Well, he does. Well, I'll be fair and say for myself.
Yeah.
Maybe some others can back this up a little bit. I never heard him talk about the legalization of rape per se, but that's me. That's me. I mean,
but he's critical of women.
There might be some things I've missed, but
right.
He's very critical of women.
Uh-huh.
Very critical of women having any kind of employment. He's done this on Fox News with Sean Hannity laughing about it. So it's he makes no bones about where he stands. And that's one of the things to bear in mind when it comes to some of the neo-fascists that we're dealing with today. They are, a lot of them are those conservatives that we've been having issues with. James O'Keefe is part of what they call the so-called alt-right. I mean, I don't like using that term, bear in mind. But every time I see him, he's with that crowd. You're talking about Chuck C. Johnson of GotNews.com. He's the guy that tried to get Michael Brown's out of Ferguson his juvenile record, even though he didn't have one. So we have some people that are in the public right-wing eye.
We just have a few minutes remaining, but I have two questions. One is, what do you see as the greatest threat that we face in the Trump administration along the lines of what we've been talking about? And then finally, what can people do if they're interested, aside from reading up and getting involved in your work? What do you advise people do in the face of such overt hatred?
I think one of the biggest threats when you talk about the Trump administration, I think the biggest threat ultimately is going to be inactivity on our part. They are more afraid of us than we are of them. They know that if we step up and make our moves, they can't make theirs. So people have to be very active when it comes to what's going to happen over the next couple of months to years or what have you. And to that point, I can't get too angry about people who are reacting adversely to the television show, but they're getting
the arts and entertainment.
The arts and entertainment program, the Generation KKK. I can't get too upset because it's a healthy thing.
It hasn't even aired yet.
It hasn't aired yet, but it's a healthy thing to be mad at the Klan. But what I will tell people is to channel that anger into the dealing with the folks like Gavin McInnes or Richard Spencer or James O'Keefe or whatever, or Ann Coulter, who is also associating herself with this crowd. Channel your energy towards going after them, because, and the people around them most importantly, because they're the ones that need to be diminished. They're the ones that need to be shut down. It's bad enough that Donald Trump is in the White House on a technicality, but that doesn't mean all is lost. He won an election. He did not win our souls. And we have to remember that about ourselves.
Well, this has been an enlightening segment. We really want to congratulate you and your ongoing efforts.
Thank you.
This certainly is the time for work such as what you're doing. And Daryl, we'd like to stay in touch and see what happens after this arts and entertainment program airs.
Yes. And by the way, I forgot to even mention this.
Yes.
It airs on January 10th at 10 o'clock on A&E.
Is this a one-time program?
It's 8 episodes. Trust me, I saw a couple of episodes, and I can tell you right now that it will knock you back.
Okay.
It will knock you back.
Daryl Lamont-Jenkins of the One People's Project, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Law & Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did 3 semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS, 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KABU 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online.
Thanks to all our affiliates. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.